You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You're listening to episode number 49 of Living the Dream with Rory O'Malley. If you like the podcast, subscribe, rate, and review. We're back, baby.
Audition, side job, swimming upstream. Believe it or not, you're living the dream.
Hello, dreamers. Rory O'Malley, your host here. We're back. It has been 2 months since I put out a podcast episode. In that time, I have wrapped up my reign as King George III in Hamilton, and I've taken some time off. I have relaxed a little bit. We had the holidays, and my husband and I really were able to enjoy my first few weeks back, and here we are. We're back at it, back on Living the Dream, the podcast. My first guest back is a wonderful guest, Wes Taylor, who I've known for years and who is so talented. He's currently in SpongeBob, the musical on Broadway. He and I did Little Miss Sunshine together. He played my former lover and who broke my heart. And we had such a great time working together. I've always admired him because he really creates his own work. He has several web series and scripts that he sold, and he's constantly creating. He is fearless in putting together work and, you know, bringing together people in the Broadway community to come together for his vision. And I just love that. I admire that so much. We also have something that we talk about that could be a little tricky if we weren't evolved actors, and hadn't, you know, been around the block a few times to kind of be able to openly discuss it. But we were both involved in Nerds the Musical, which I've talked about on the podcast quite a bit. The musical that fell apart back in 2016 and led me to eventually be in Hamilton. But I was playing Bill Gates. It was about Bill Gates and Steve Jobs. And 3 weeks into rehearsal, the producer told all of us that an investor dropped out and that we would not be opening on Broadway that season. It was very, very sad. I didn't realize that Wes actually had been playing Bill Gates in earlier readings and concert versions of the show and was really attached to it for quite some time. I was able to talk about that with him, and he's the best because he's just honest. And we talked about his feelings during that time, what he was thinking and feeling when he found out that the show that passed over him after he put in all the work was announced that it was going to not even open, how he felt, and a lot of feelings, lots of feelings. There's just a lot of feelings in this business, right? And I think it's really important when actors who are going through the same types of things connect with each other about how they feel. Maybe not in the moment, but certainly afterwards. I learned a lot from that experience. And clearly Wes did as well. So we get into it. We're not afraid to get into the hard stuff here at Living the Dream. So enjoy, and thank you so much for listening. I'm so glad to be back. Hi, Wes.
Hi, this Rory.
Welcome to Living the Dream. This is it. It just happened. You're on it.
Oh, my God. Wow.
Can you even believe it?
I can't. I can't.
I'm so, so glad that you're doing this because I contacted you a couple of months ago And we were trying to make it happen.
Yeah, we were sort of playing tag for a while. And
yes, yes. Yeah. And when I heard you were going to SpongeBob, I was so, so excited for you that you were going to do
that's
that.
That's so weird. So was I.
Good, yeah. Good. I'm glad you were happy about it. But I was upset because I knew you were in LA and you were going back to New York and I was going to miss you. So I was looking forward to hanging out with you.
Womp, womp.
Womp, womp. So how's it going? You've opened in December. You're in the run.
Yeah, we're a few months in now, I guess, because we started previews at the beginning of November. So we're in our third month of the run. And it's so fun. I mean, it's just the most insanely creative show on Broadway. I mean, like, I like to be humble about the shows I'm in, but not this one. I'm, like, so proud of it. I think
I haven't gotten to see it. I'm not even on the right coast to see it, but I've heard so many wonderful things. And people, like, not just young kids, but, like, people our age are like, I want to go back and see SpongeBob again. It's so
honestly,
much fun.
Honestly, I mean, it really is more for millennials. I mean, more for the people who grew up on the cartoon. I mean, the kids, of course, you know, it's very inventive and it's color vomit. It's like just the most stimulation for your senses. But a lot of the jokes go over the kids' heads, of course, more the intellectual humor. It's more for parents. You know, it's kind of the show for the whole family, not to sound like the marketing team. But yeah, I would really... I would suggest it to any age. It's just so delirious and fun.
It's a big cast. It's so big.
You know, there's about 20 of us. No,
wow. Yeah,
it's not that big.
Oh, I guess I saw you guys on the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, and I was just like, wow, this, I think maybe because of the costumes.
Yeah, the costumes.
It's so epic and big.
The design is nuts. I mean, it's you know, definitely larger than life and epic and... Yeah.
Yeah. Is it what's the mix of people? Is it like some Broadway debuts or?
Oh yeah, we have like 12 Broadway debuts or something.
Wow.
Crazy.
A lot
of fresh faces, yeah.
It's kind of funny because like in Hamilton, I'm the old man.
Yeah. And, totally.
And it's like how did this happen?
How did this happen? Yeah. Me and Gavin Lee and Lily Cooper, you know, we've been around the block, but
yeah,
everyone else.
Well, you've been around the block since you guys were all so young.
Yeah.
I mean, you were so young when you went on a Broadway and you know, it's funny to be a veteran at your age, but you are, it's a young man's game.
It's
Broadway.
True.
But you started in Florida. Is that right?
Sure did.
In Orlando.
Well done on your homework.
Yes.
Were
you born there or you were?
No. I was actually born in Elizabeth, New Jersey.
Mm, okay.
But I was only there for about a month. They moved my sister and baby Wes down to Orlando. Orlando. To raise a family right at Disney World. So I had 18 years of my life, was next to Mickey. And then,
See the Florida Project?
I sure did. I've watched it a couple times actually. And it's such a good movie. And that movie takes place on sort of the outskirts of Central Florida, like the outskirts of Disney, the sort of bleak,
right,
depressing, International Drive sort of touristy,
sure,
desolation. It is where the poverty is. And I know those characters. I know those people. And yeah. So what a devastating film, though.
Oh my god! It was beautifully done and just so, so sad.
Yeah.
But I thought it was brilliant. I don't know. I just thought it was. I talked to some people who grew up in Orlando, or in the Florida, South Florida area.
It's a strange place to grow up, to be honest.
Yeah, it's a strange place. Like, I can only imagine for anyone to be a drive away from the happiest place on earth.
Yeah.
You know? And
well, I had an interesting experience when I was a child because, you know, growing up there, you watch all the game shows on TV and they're like, win a family package, 4 tickets to Orlando, to Disney World. And you're like, what the hell? I'm already here.
Right.
Like, what's the big whoop?
Right. Oh, wow.
And the magic sort of dies at an early age, you know, unfortunately. Yeah.
Did you go a lot?
Yeah. Not only did I go there, I worked there. You sort of have to. It's like your rite of passage when you live there.
Yeah, of course.
I worked at all the theme
parks. I wanted
to
work at Cedar Point. That was our amusement park.
Oh.
But couldn't get a job there. Moving on. So you grew up in Florida. Was there a lot of theater around?
Yeah, there was. I mean, I knew from an early age that this is what I wanted to do. And I sort of bugged my parents pretty frequently to take me out on auditions. And I got an agent when I was 9 in Orlando. So yeah, I started doing like dinner theaters and little equity playhouses around Orlando. And there was the Orlando Broadway Dinner Theater, of course. I did many a show. But yeah, there was a pretty thriving theater scene, especially for the youth. There's Orlando Youth Theater and Civic Kids. And I went to a performing arts high school in Orlando that was across the street from Universal Studios.
Oh, okay. Was that? It's not where Michael James Scott.
That is where Michael James Scott went. Yes.
And Jessica Rush.
Yep.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, there's lots and lots of people on Broadway that went to that high school. It's, behind the scenes too. A lot of stagehands and design students.
That's great.
Yeah.
Does it teach all that, or is it just like a healthy design?
It has a very healthy arts program. I mean, it's a magnet school, visual and performing arts magnet program.
Okay.
And they've got, you know, money and there's a lot of, yeah, exposure experience. You know, I would say, I don't know how much I learned about the craft of acting before college, before drama school, but not that. That being said, like, I was exposed to so much great theater in high school, and like, you know, we did so much Shakespeare, and like, a lot of people, it's controversial. Like, should high schoolers be doing Macbeth before? Oh shit! I just said Macbeth, and I'm in my dressing room right now.
Oh no! Turn around 3 times and
spit
in the
and
corner.
Curse. All right, hold on.
Yeah.
Fuck!
Oh wow! Okay. Oh my god!
Shit! Piss! All
right. Wow.
Hopefully the show doesn't crash and burn tonight, because I said the Scottish play out loud in the theater.
Good luck tonight, Bob.
Oh, yeah. So what I was saying was I think that people sometimes think that high schoolers shouldn't be doing such advanced material when they, you know, don't have the life experience or don't have the knowledge of the text or whatever. But I disagree. I think that you should just sort of dive in as early as possible and learn as much as you can through experience and through just trying it on for size.
Oh my God, if a high schooler is like doing anything with Shakespeare, just be happy.
Yeah.
They're like involved or
right.
excited about it. God, you know, I mean, if that's what their people are worried about. So you end up going to North Carolina School for the Arts, right?
Yes, yes. That's where I went for college.
And you went through the audition process. Did you go to North Carolina?
I did,
or
yeah.
Did you?
So, okay. So one of the great things about the high school that I went to is they do these college tours and they go up pretty much just the East Coast, but they stop at North Carolina School of the Arts. They stop in Chicago, like DePaul, Roosevelt sort of stuff. They stop in New York and see a bunch of Broadway shows, go visit Juilliard, NYU.
Wait, is it all on a bus?
CUNY. Yeah, bus.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you take a bus from Florida to all those places?
Well, sometimes, like, so every other year they change. Like, they always go to New York.
Oh, okay.
But sometimes they'll go to, you know, visit the Salem Witch Trials because they just read The Crucible versus
right.
Chicago or D.C. Like, they change a few of the outside states that they're visiting.
I see.
But you hit, like, a fair amount of top theater schools, which I was grateful for. And And for me, it was, I definitely knew I wanted a conservatory over the sort of university or liberal arts education. And so I was looking at Juilliard and NCSA, and I actually didn't know anything about Carnegie Mellon, and I would have looked into that, obviously, if I would have known about it, because it's a great school. That's where you went, right?
Yes. That's where I went. I didn't really know too much about it until like my junior year. And it was like 2 hours from my house. So I didn't want to go because I was like, I want to get out of here. But I realized it was definitely the right place for me. You were at North Carolina and you were studying acting, but you definitely had you had musical theater there as well, or no?
No, they don't have musical theater there, but music was always a part of my life because my mom was a music teacher. And so it was sort of introduced very early on, and we were singing and pretty frequently. But I really wanted to be an actor, and I did a lot of musicals in high school and stuff. But I didn't necessarily want to go to school for musical theater. No judgment, of course, to any of my friends that did go for musical theater, who are all like littering the Broadway stage and doing very well. But for me, it wasn't Broadway or bust. For me, I really wanted to do television and film, and I wanted to be trained as an actor first, and then, keeping up with the other sort of skills if I could. So there was like a lot of movement-oriented classes at School of the Arts, and also, like tap for actors, jazz for actors, basic sort of tools. But I was always sort of a natural mover, and to me, it wasn't super important to be super versed in dance if you want to be like the principals of the musicals. If you want to be the lead of the musical, you don't have to be as good of a dancer as the ensemble.
Right.
So I studied voice on the side. I took private voice lessons on our one day off from school and rehearsal. And then we had singing class as part of the training as well, because that was a part of drama school, was singing and music theory. And so we got that stuff, even though it was a drama school. Not as much, I'm sure, as CCM, Michigan, whatever. But yeah, that was sort of important to me. And I really do think I went to the place I needed to go to.
Isn't it funny how you worry about it so much before you go to school?
Yeah.
And then in the end, it's like, you're going to wind up in the right place because they know the place better than you do. And they're going to find you. People, I think when I was 18 years old, I knew where I needed to go. I knew what I needed to do. But then everything unfolds the way it's supposed to. And it's always what you make of it. Like you taking voice lessons on top of your curriculum. You made the most of it. If you hadn't done that, who knows what opportunities. It's not just about having the talent. It's about being like proactive enough and feeling prepared enough that you've done the work so that when you go to that singing audition with a bunch of kids from CCM, you're not like, oh, I can't do this. You're like, hell yeah, I can do this. I took my voice lessons. So you got out of school there and you went straight to New York or no?
Yes. I was always itching to live in New York since I was a kid. We would go to New York on our family vacations, like spring breaks and Christmas breaks and stuff. And I always knew that was the destination after school. So as soon as we graduated, I moved like that day or the next day to New York and crashed with a couple buds from college in Brooklyn at first. And yeah.
And was it just, was it like just exciting the moment you got there, or was it like, oh shit, I'm in New York City?
Oh no, I was so stupid excited.
It's funny that you're born in New Jersey, because I'm not saying you are New Yorker, but you just are way more of a New Yorker than you are somebody from Florida.
Oh, I know. I mean, oh, absolutely. I don't want to say that I'm not proud of Florida. I will say like the Pulse shootings in Orlando, there's always something about tragedy that gives you a sense of pride if you're from there, a sense of ownership and connection. So I don't want to dog on it. But I, at the same time, I don't go back to Florida very often. It doesn't feel like home, whereas New York City feels like home. And it always sort of has. Like right when I moved here, when I was 21 years old, it felt like home. It felt like I was moving home, even though I was just moving there for the first time.
Right.
It just felt natural.
Right. What did you do to survive when you got there? Did you have side jobs? What did you do?
Well, I was pretty lucky. I got some work right off the bat. So I was doing like the O'Neill Festival a couple weeks after graduation, and then I did C-Rock City, which is this new musical that was being premiered at Barrington Stage in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. So I did like a couple like small regional gigs right out the gate, and then Rock of Ages happened a few months after school. So
wow, so you went. Rock of Ages happened that fast after school. I didn't realize.
Well, I was, yeah, I'd say, so by August, I was at New World Stages doing Rock of Ages, the off-Broadway production. And then we were transferring to Broadway by that winter. So.
Wow. So August after you graduated.
Yeah.
Wow.
So basically six months after school, I was on Broadway, which is nuts.
That's amazing.
It is amazing and rare and overwhelming.
Yeah.
And crazy. And it's a whirlwind. And now looking back, I have so much perspective and like, I don't know.
Well, I mean, I've had this conversation with some people, you know, it took me probably 3 or 4 years out of school until I was on Broadway. And I was living in Los Angeles at that time. So I was not working, especially not for money.
Mm.
I was working at 99 Seat Theaters in LA. And when I got there, it felt like I had finished a marathon.
Mm.
I was to standby on Broadway, and it was like, oh, this is insane. Obviously it would be insane at 22 coming right out of school, but there's also, it's great. But it must have had a different kind of challenge.
Oh, for sure.
For you. I feel like I'm kind of grateful that I didn't have to figure out how to be on Broadway at 22.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's so many pros and cons to that landing in your lap.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many great, amazing, overwhelming, exciting things that happen with that. But there's also some drawbacks, some serious drawbacks, and some loneliness and some natural sort of distancing of friends and, you know, that sort of alienation of like, you have nothing to complain about because you're on Broadway. Right. And so no one wants to hear anything that's wrong with you. Right. And so you sort of have to like, just be okay with it. I don't know. I mean,
well, and you weren't just on Broadway. You were kicking ass on Broadway with an amazing number that was like hysterical.
And thank you, Rory.
Big part. I mean, you did.
No, it was you're right. It was a stupid Broadway debut. It was like, I got this silly 11 o'clock number 6 months out of college. I mean, I was just, and the thing is, I'm saying lucky now, but at the time, it's so funny because at the time, when people told me every day how lucky I was and like, did I realize how crazy I was, like, I resented it. I resented that people called it luck because I was like, how dare you? No, I've worked for this my entire life. This is the natural like course of events that happens when you've wanted this your whole life. You've worked for this your whole life. This is meant to happen. I was meant to be on this trajectory. It's like, you have to, like, there's no way you can appreciate what's happening and be grateful for it until you've experienced unemployment and you've truly experienced living hand to mouth, paycheck to paycheck. Because every actor has to go through that. I really believe that. I mean, some are very lucky to never have any ebb and flow, but most actors are going to have a drought. And I had to have my drought after, like, I did Rock of Ages, right into Addams Family, right into Smash. It was 5 consecutive years of work. And after Smash, I finally started having a drought of like living episodic to episodic or off Broadway show to regional gig and being like, shit, how do people do this? How do people save their money? Like, and I had that in my second half of my 20s of like, shit, I got to figure this out. Right. I have to figure out how to save my money and to have longevity in this business.
Right.
Because I was a stupid kid who lived on Central Park West by myself.
You did?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Because no one told me, like, how... Right. I mean, I just was like, oh, I'm invincible. Like, this is going to last forever. I'm going to be on Broadway for the rest of my life. Because you have no perspective.
I'm convinced, I'm convinced that in college, they literally should have a full semester that's completely devoted to finances, to understanding what unemployment is, to figuring out what to do as a side job, what your other skills are, so that you can take care of yourself in the moments you're not bringing in any income, and to talk to other actors about that reality. Honestly, that's why I'm having these conversations, because no one talks about this stuff. They don't. Everyone wants to talk about what they're doing. That's the big Broadway show or the movie, but they don't want to talk about those hard times. And the fact that the hard times don't go away after your Broadway debut. They don't go away after you win an Oscar. Yeah. After you win an Oscar, you will still have to fight and figure out how to pay your bills. Yeah. Because jobs don't always come in. In fact, people say that, like, winning an Oscar is a curse, especially if you're a character actor. So it's always a struggle, but it's like you have to enjoy that struggle. Are you getting a call?
No. So basically I'm up in my dressing, you hear that?
Yeah.
So basically I'm up in my dressing room and they're starting a brush up choreography rehearsal downstairs.
I heard something about tap shoes.
Yeah. So I
grab your tap shoes, kids.
I'm not called until 2:30. So I'm just at the palace very early talking to you, but, the ensemble starts rehearsal now.
Got it. Got to get that ensemble. Yeah. Working. As if they don't work hard enough.
So they work harder than anyone.
So more than anyone. Yes. More than anyone. So what I was going to say is I'm so impressed with you because you are constantly creating your own work. And you have been since Rock of Ages, which now I realize was the first thing you did out of school, like 6 months after. So your entire career, you have been writing, putting together a web series, selling shows. That takes a ton of work. It takes a ton of stamina. What is your process in doing that? And what have you learned from it?
Well, it started in Rock of Ages with Mitch Jarvis and Lauren Molina, who were co-stars with me in Rock of Ages. And the three of us were backstage. You know, after the thing is, before Rock of Ages, I mean, all I had done was high school, college. I did, you know, community theater professional like stuff when I was younger, but never more than 8 weeks of a run of anything. And here I was doing a show for months and months and months and months and like going a little crazy. And we were making these backstage silly videos, right? Just to keep ourselves entertained. And this was like really before any Broadway show was doing backstage videos, like before any.
Yeah. I remember watching it and being like, oh, wow, what a good idea. Use your time to be creative backstage.
And also, like, there's such a built-in audience because the fans of the show are going to want to see it.
Right.
And they're going to want to see what the actors do backstage in their costumes, like shenanigans. And so we sort of had this built-in audience watching. And so we were like, oh, people care. People want it. So let's keep making them. And then it was like, oh, let's actually put some effort into this and organize it. Oh, let's write a script. Oh, let's do a sketch. Oh, And then I left Rock of Ages to do Adams. And I really missed that. I really missed making those stupid videos. So then I started my first sort of narrative-driven web series, and it was just like my first foray into like telling somewhat of a story. And that was Billy Green, which was this YouTube sketch sort of series that you know, they're like short little episodes that we shot on a point-and-shoot camera, like super super low budget. I mean, no budget, just like walking around with a little point and shoot camera. But fans went nuts for it and like really loved it. And, So then I had a little bit of a fan base, you know, in terms of web content. And I was like, well, I got to keep this up. So then, Billy Green was during the Addams Family, just sort of like needing to feel creatively fulfilled. After you do 400 performances of anything, you're like struggling not to do your grocery list on stage. It's like at that point, the muscle memory, whether you like it or not, you can do the show in your sleep, which is a scary feeling for an actor to just be on stage and your muscles are doing the work and you can be checked out. And, you know, I don't know anything more horrifying for an actor who wants to be present and in the moment.
Exactly. Being on stage is supposed to make you feel alive in a way that nothing else can. So when that happens, you're like, okay, what's the point?
I'm just a robot. I'm just like,
I'm not
doing a machine. Yeah. So that was really important for me to stay stimulated and inspired. So we were doing that web series, doing Addams Family. And then I went and did Smash. And just like any job, after the excitement of the first few months wears off, it becomes a job. And then it's just amazing how, like, you know, before Smash, I had only done like some soap opera stuff and some commercials. And Smash was my first real television gig. And what a television gig to start on. It was like $4 million an episode, a Steven Spielberg scale show. And yet it's just funny how quickly that it wasn't enough. Like, I was like, why don't I have more screen time? Why don't I have more of a part? Why, you know, where I want a bigger part. I want, you know. So then, you know, then I started getting a little bored, creatively stifled, and we started It Could Be Worse, which was the next web series. And then people really got into that one and wanted a second season of it. And so we did a Kickstarter, raised about $100,000, shot the second season in Los Angeles, sold it to Hulu. Now I have this sort of writing deal with Anonymous Content in LA, and they commissioned me a year ago to write a digital short, which I sold. So I'm just sort of kicking around some projects. And Alex Wise and I did a little web series of our own last summer when I was living in LA. And we're going to do a second season of that this spring. We're writing it actually right now.
This is so much. Like, all that what you just described is so much work. When we were doing Little Miss Sunshine together.
Oh, yeah.
I remember you writing the second season of It Could Be Worse.
And yeah, I forgot. Like, it was actually all during Little Miss Sunshine that I was raising the money, Kickstarter.
Yes, that's right. I think I made some videos.
You not only made some videos, you donated $25. James Lapine donated $25 too.
You remember how much?
I remember how much every person gave.
Oh my God. Wait, $25. I was on a second stage contract. So
first of all,
that's pretty good.
No shame whatsoever. That's what all of my friends gave, and I was very grateful for those 25s. Those 25s add up.
They sure do. They sure do. I think I had at one point, like, I could only give $25 Kickstarters when it was like the Kickstarter craze, you know, when you want to give to everyone.
But then, like, every day there was a new Kickstarter.
Yeah. There was like a year there where there were so many Kickstarters, and they weren't all like yours.
No.
Where you were like in your second season, you're doing something. They were like, I think I want to try this for the first time.
And then it got ridiculous. Then it was like, pay for my gym membership.
Yeah. And there were lots of things that I was like, oh no.
Oh,
you should not be asking for money for this.
Yeah.
For what you were doing. I mean, it had such a technical aspect, a huge cost. And so when you're talking about raising $100,000 and having that technical side, how did you feel confident about taking on that challenge? Was it really just from learning how to work with a camera and just goofing around at Rock of Ages? And then all of a sudden you have, I mean, it could be worse. You guys had the real deal there. You had a wonderful tech crew.
I mean, fake it till you make it. Like,
right. You
always have to, I feel like most of us walk into any first day of any job, no matter what it is, feeling like a fraud and feeling like you don't belong or like that you don't deserve it or something. And if you just pretend like you do or just act like you belong and like I don't know. It's mostly tricking yourself into it. So, you know, I
feel like that's one of the benefits of getting into a Broadway show at 22, because I would never think that you're faking it ever. Remember like when we were doing Little Miss Sunshine, I was trying to get a show at Joe's Pub, and I think I talked to you about it, and I was like, oh, I just emailed someone at Joe's Pub and they told me they didn't have dates for this next month. So I guess they don't want me to be there. And you were like, no, you tell them you want to do a show. You say, let me know when you're ready for me to be doing a show there.
Yeah.
And then I did. And I was like, oh, he thinks differently about this stuff. You know what I mean?
Well, I will say like that.
I'm asking for permission. And you're like, this is just what's going to happen.
Yeah, that is true. That is something about me. But that's also comes from my like bossy, like little dictator ways. Like when I was a kid, I had a stage in my backyard that I built with my dad, and I would force the neighborhood children to do my plays. And like, you know, you got tickets for good behavior. And like at the end of the summer, whoever had the most tickets got a super soaker. And you, like I was a
you
crazy
had a
person.
Discipline program of
yeah.
tickets?
Yeah, sure.
So the tickets aren't tickets to the play. They're like gold stars.
No, they were gold stars. Yeah. I mean, I had to find a way to keep the kids interested and not going back to play video games or like whatever they wanted to do instead of being out in the sun rehearsing The Music Man, you know?
Oh my God.
So, you know, I've always been sort of a crazy person who bosses people around to get what I want. And I think that, that has been very helpful in terms of recruiting celebrity to do readings of my plays or be in sketch videos, because, you know, as gross as that sounds, famous faces bring eyeballs to the content. And, you know, I'm always sort of asking these fancy favors of people I know or kind of know or did one reading with. But I think a lot of people are scared to, you know, of what that celebrity might say or how they'll react or how they'll just like reject you or turn. I'm like, what's the worst that can happen? They say no. So I've gotten very ballsy in terms of just asking for what I want, or just like you with the Joe's Pub thing, just demanding it.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. It's so funny because, you know, like I asked them if they had something over the next few weeks, they said no. And I was just going to let it go. And you were like, no, you go back and you say, let's figure out when I'm going to be performing on your stage.
I don't even remember this conversation, but I believe you.
I do. Because it's something that I really had to learn, that it is, I think it is a skill. It's really walking into fear, being courageous enough and having enough confidence to know that you are worthy of asking somebody something, especially when it's, When you're saying, do you want to be a part of this cool thing that I'm putting all of my efforts into?
Right.
And I think that everyone who knows you knows that if you're asking, it's not some shit show that they're being asked to be a part of.
Right.
You're really putting all of yourself into it.
Yeah.
And so I think that like when you get somebody to do something, it's amazing how all these other people come along.
That's exactly right. I mean, that's how you get, I mean, that's sort of, you have to sort of be a dirty producer sometimes, but you got to sort of seduce people into playing with you, based on the other perks,
right.
Based on whatever you can do or sell to make it seem a little more exciting or what have you. But
it's a part of it. And, you know, it's like, oh, maybe a little skeezy, but it's not, it's just what it is, you know?
Yeah. It is what it is.
So you talked about that time after Smash that you were going from gig to gig in regional theaters. That was probably around the same time that we were doing Little Miss Sunshine. How do you keep, besides making your own work and selling to Hulu and doing so many things creatively, how do you keep a positive headspace throughout those times when you're not really sure what's going to happen next? Where you're going to go?
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm not going to lie. It's really hard to do what we do. And
yeah,
I feel like it sort of takes a crazy person to commit to this lifestyle forever.
Oh yeah.
And whenever someone leaves the business, I never think of them as quitters. I think of them as like, oh, they got out, you know, like,
right.
It can be pretty demoralizing, when you're not working, to get yourself through those times. But it does help that I'm a writer, and it really, a lot of times when I'm doing really well, when things are going really well, I'm a terrible writer. So it also is interesting that when I go through these like stretches of bleak, sort of empty, you know, not a lot of work, or feeling anxious about the future or whatnot, that sometimes that's my better writing. But how do you get through it? I mean, financially, you collect unemployment. I mean, or you get another job. You do readings, you create, you go to the gym, you try to keep your mind and body healthy. Therapy, this career is not for the weak. I mean,
no. And you have to have a good support system of friends.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, it's my relationship with my husband,
Gerald. Yeah.
Because it's because he's not in the business. So every time I want to kind of wallow or be sad, it's like, get over it. This is part of your job. So just, you know, figure it out how to be happy today, because you get to do something that's really, really
yeah.
cool that everybody else would love to do.
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting, but that's also him talking to you while you're in Hamilton complaining about something. You know what I mean? Like,
true.
It is quite different to be unemployed or like to be complaining when you're employed. I mean, like, not saying that you don't deserve to complain about anything when you're employed, but like, he's right. I mean, there are times when I really don't want to come to work even now, you know, or like I want to get out of the city, or I want to day drink, or I want to have dinner at a reasonable hour, or I want to wake. Anyway, all, you know, there are plenty of things that, you know, the grass will always be greener, but I'm able now, as a 31-year-old now, to look at my job, even sometimes within the monotony or the routine of it all, and really appreciate it and really like enjoy this third month of the run, you know? Whereas when I was younger, in my early 20s, I was already at this point itching for what's next and what can I do? That's how else can I contribute to society? Like, I need to keep going. I'm restless. I'm antsy. And now I can sit back and enjoy it a little bit more. It's really nice.
Yeah, no, it comes with age in this business.
Yeah.
Of being around long enough to understand and appreciate just anything. Really, like even in times of unemployment, I have to know that I'm so grateful to have this money saved. I'm so grateful that I have this group, that I have this time where I'm not working, because I have to trust that there will be another job. I don't want to be completely anxious throughout this entire time where I don't have anything to do, because I won't have time off once I get ever whatever the next job is.
Correct.
And that takes a lot of experience and a lot of trust in yourself and what the business is. So one of the things that we talked about when we talked about doing this was nerds. Do you want to talk about nerds?
Oh.
Because I'm not sure I want to talk about nerds, but we did discuss it. And I thought, well, this would probably be a good conversation to have on the podcast, because
I know we can have
a really honest one, and you know, I think it's a real situation that happens.
Well, of course, it's vulnerable. And yet that's what I love about this podcast that you're doing, is that you want to sort of talk about the extreme highs and lows of what we do and the pitfalls of the business. And so nerds is sort of this perfect example of
nerds basically is why I'm doing this podcast.
Oh, yes. I think I heard you say that. I listened to the to the one you did with Alex Wise. And I mean, who should start?
I'll start.
Okay.
I mean, in January of 2016, I got an email from, I was sitting in a Starbucks with Josh Gad, and it said, would you want to play Bill Gates on Broadway in like in 8 weeks? It was like in two months time, there was an offer for a Broadway
show.
Just
a straight offer for a lead on Broadway.
Yes. And so I was, for me, I thought, oh, this must become some kind of joke. Uh-huh. Like, I was like, what is this? I was in Los Angeles. I didn't know. I'd never worked with anyone on the team. I knew.
You knew Casey.
Yeah, I knew Casey. I knew her through Casey Nicola. Mm-hmm. But I'd never worked with her. And I knew that they had asked me to do a reading in the past, and that Casey had seen me because I assisted, or she assisted on something that she worked on, I don't know, a musical a few years before. So I knew, I was like, oh, that's okay. Yes, I kind of remember this vaguely. And then I read through the script, and I had recordings of the writers who, you know, had these demos of them doing the raps and stuff,
yeah,
of Bill Gates, the Bill Gates rap. And I specifically remember Googling it and saying, like, oh, Lauren and Wes and some other people I know worked on this at some point. Maybe I should call them up and see what their experience was.
Yeah, really glad you didn't.
I know. I mean, this is the thing, is that I honestly, it was one of those things where, like, it was like a press release on Playbill and it didn't even say what you were playing. I swear to God, like at that point, I didn't even think that you were, I thought that you were Steve Jobs, but I didn't know. So I almost called you. And even when I got that, and when we got there and it happened so fast, I thought, you know, this just landed here. It's a lead in a Broadway show. What's the worst that can happen? And then the worst that can happened.
Oh man.
But it wasn't, for me, it was, the hardest part was, for those of you who don't know, the show collapsed 3 weeks into rehearsals because the producers didn't have enough money. So what was hard for me was to watch all the people who invested their years of writing to see, you know, people who were going to make their Broadway debuts have that dream taken away from them. It was devastating to be witness to that. For me, it was just, you know, I hadn't even had that much time to be that invested. I didn't know that Lauren Molina, I can be naive sometimes. I have so much respect for you and Lauren. I thought you guys turned it down.
Right.
I just was assumed that this was something that you guys were like,
pass.
Pass. And I honestly thought, man, they must not have had a good experience with these people and they're dodging a bullet, which, by the way, you did. And I thought, well, I totally respect them. I felt like, for me, it was, I'm going to go and maybe this will close in 6 months, but it will be good to do it. And I respect them for passing. It wasn't until I got to New York in rehearsals and saw Lauren that I realized that she hadn't been asked, which just shocked me.
And her longtime boyfriend,
yes,
who was going to make his Broadway debut, you know.
Right, was in it. Yeah. So there were so many feelings going on right off the bat. And I don't just love both of you guys personally. I think you're phenomenally talented.
Oh my God, I adore you. Of course, it was never about you.
No, I know. But that's why this is such a interesting thing to talk about, because I didn't know that you felt upset in any way at that time. And obviously, I feel badly because I probably should have called you.
Actually,
Just to make sure that you were okay. Not like, oh, you know, is it okay if I do this? But
I don't know. I'm actually not sure if that would have been better, because it was a pretty, it was kind of a dark time for me. And I benefit from the time away from it to gain right. perspective and to be able to talk about it with a clear head and class. Because I was angry. And I'm going to talk about it. This is like, I think the best forum to talk about it on your podcast. And also like I just said, with time away from it, cause I'm not interested in like trashing anyone's name, but I think that this is very like, this is part of the business that doesn't get talked about and people don't really know about who don't deal in it.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
But, so I got a text message a few years back from one of the producers of Rock of Ages. And he was one of the head producers. And, you know, Rock of Ages was my Broadway debut and a very special experience. And I'm very close to that producing team and all those creatives. And he basically said the same thing to me a few years back of, hey, do you want to play Bill Gates on Broadway? And I immediately was like, me? What? Why me? I don't look anything like Bill Gates. I don't have the blonde hair and the glasses and the blue eye, the dorky sort of thing. I'm a little, and he's like, this musical is different. And he has the spirit of you. The sort of ambitious, dark, thing. Sort of villainous in a way. We want him to dance and rap and all this stuff. And so I, for a couple years, developed it with them. Meaning I was doing readings and concerts, you know, for free. Like I did a concert for free to help them with advanced set. I did a thing at Hard Rock Cafe. I was doing all these little tiny commitments. We performed the rap at this thing and we did that. And then we did a full, like an official lab of the show, like a 4-week lab in which I was the only one who got right of first refusal, which I thought was interesting that I was the only one, even though some people had been workshopping the show for years and years and years, but they seemed very set on me playing this part. And Casey, the director, you know, looked at me and said, you're the best Bill Gates that I've had in 10 years. We've been working on this for years and years and years, and you're irreplaceable. and you know, look, when you're waiting for a Broadway house to open up, you know, it's a nerve-wracking time. I knew that they wanted nerds to come in, and they were sort of on a few waiting lists. But the fact that I was on like a text thread with the creative team, like Marquee opened up, but it's too big for us. We're not taking it. Like I was a part of those conversations. I was basically like a part of the creative team. It was like, they were all my friends. The choreographer and I worked together on Smash. The music director and I had worked together on previous workshops. The you know, like I knew all of these people well. And I had been replaced from American Psycho after a couple years of working on that. And here's the thing, like, this is not my first time at the rodeo. Like, developing new theater, new musical theater especially, is soul-crushing a lot of the time because you're constantly doing readings and workshops of things that you're replaced in by celebrities or fresh faces or whatever. That's what happens after years of working on a project. You're sort of expendable sometimes. And I was feeling burned by the theater community. It had been like several years since I was on Broadway, and I was developing so much new material and getting sort of kicked to the curb at the end, you know, right when it was about to get real. And American Psycho had just replaced me. And then I had heard, not through the creative team, but through someone else, that Nerds was coming in, so the Long Acre. And so I immediately sort of was reaching out to the team and being like, hey, what's up? What's going on? And they were sort of avoiding my calls. And then And then I got a call from the director saying, you know, look, I'd be lying if I told you I wasn't getting pressure from producers to shop for celebrity. And now here's the thing. Like,
I'm sorry, I'm laughing. It's just, no, you know, it's obviously just, their search just, went wrong somewhere. Yeah, they wound up with me.
It's so funny. It's so funny because, like, that's what I knew that was going to happen. Like, I'm right. not saying casting you, but I knew that celebrities were going to pass because they inevitably did. They went to two different celebrities who said no first. And I knew that was going to happen. Celebrities are scared of lowbrow material. And Nerds was very much a stupid humor show. It was, you know, in the vein of Rock of Ages.
Very broad and fun.
Yeah, very fun, but like very sort of lowbrow. And, you know, celebrities get scared of that kind of stuff. And it wasn't a jukebox musical. It was like an original score. It was like quite risky to not be coming from any source material. And so I sort of knew that celebrities were going to pass. That's why I told my team to wait around for them to come back to us, because even if I had reservations about the show succeeding or not, I loved the part. I thought it was just a blast. I wasn't working and I was broke and I wanted to enter into that leading man category. However long the show lasted. So, you know, what I said to the director when she told me they were going to entertain, you know, famous people, I was like, look, I totally get it as a producer myself. You know, if I'm producing all this web content and like readings of my plays and things, I know the value of fame. I know how that gets asses in the theater. I know how it creates buzz for a project and all of that. However, if you take a look at the track record of successful, long-running new musicals, it's never celebrity. Right. They become celebrity once the show is a hit. But if you look at Avenue Q, Book of Mormon, In the Heights, Spring Awakening, Hamilton, these are all theater people who became famous after the show became famous. And it's such a interesting formula that people always forget that you really need theater talent to land a new musical. I really believe that to be true. So, you know, this was an agonizing time for me because I had been replaced from a couple Broadway shows within the span of a couple months. I felt really burned by the community. And then at the same time, while this was happening, I sold a script in LA. Literally on the day they announced Nerds was canceled, I was testing for a pilot in LA.
Right.
And so it was like,
that must have felt really good.
It did. And yet, of course,
and I'm happy for you for that.
I mean, look, I couldn't share my happiness with anyone, obviously, or else I'd be a monster for celebrating in the face of my friends losing their Broadway jobs. And yet, I will say, and this will be a controversial. This will be controversial.
Oh boy!
But I will say there
getting
is
getting controversial. I'm living the
just
dream.
Brace yourself, Rory. There is something to be said about when you're replaced, fired, when things go wrong in the business, and they announce it and they make it public. The theater community takes care of you, and what I mean is, I don't think it's that much of a coincidence that all of the leads, I think, other than one. In Nerds ended up on Broadway within months in different shows. You were in Hamilton. Lindsay got Significant Other. Patty got Frozen. Like it was like,
yeah,
it all seemed to work out for you guys.
And Brian's doing the lead in Waitress on tour.
There you go. So it just felt like everyone was taking care. You know, when Jeremy Jordan was replaced by Matt Morrison in Finding Neverland, It's like he was on Supergirl a few weeks later. It's like there is something to be said about like airing out what's happening to you. Cause then people, I don't know, there's a subconscious, well, I'm going to grab that guy and put him in my show, you know?
Right.
Now
no,
that he's
I mean,
available.
Yes. Without a doubt. For me, it was like, it'd be the exact reason why I was in Hamilton, because it was Bethany Knox casting and she came to the room when we ran through the show and 2 days later, she called my agent to be like, you know, hey,
can you do there you go.
I know he's free.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's because, you know, when I was attached to the show for 2 years and then was sort of secretly kicked to the curb, no one knows that. So no one's going to take care of little Wes.
Right.
It was a really hard time for me. And, I'm sure. And sort of a rude awakening about the business and how you're not owed anything. No one owes you anything. You're not entitled to anything. The business sucks through and through. And you just have to keep swimming, you know, because eventually, you know, it's just interesting how I've done so much development of theater and then sort of replaced at the end. Whereas now I sidestepped all the development on SpongeBob and I just skipped right to the Broadway show.
Right.
So it's like sort of a beautiful karmic sort of thing.
Yeah.
But no one knows, you know, like you asked me if that day was very happy for me. Yes, of course. Like it was sort of, I got about 50 text messages from friends and people I'd worked with, agents, managers who were like, karma's a bitch. Ha 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 ha.
Yeah.
And yes, of course that, you know, that felt nice. But at the same time, it's conflicting because all your friends are crying and like, you know, it's hard to see. And then also the biggest thing is because you guys didn't open, I never got paid my kill fee.
Mm.
So I was
right.
Like really counting on that check because right. It was a very cute paycheck that I was expecting and I needed for survival.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they had a problem with money. So
yeah, they had a little problem with
money.
A
lot of people waiting for some checks that just weren't going to come.
Yeah.
But I'm just so grateful that you would be honest about that.
Oh my God.
Situation.
Oh yeah, I was never upset with you.
Oh no. Yeah, I know. But just to talk about it on here, because I do think that story for me, and clearly that story for you, is such a defining moment of understanding what this business is. And when that happened, I was like, wow, this is a whole new level of disappointment I didn't even know existed.
Yeah.
And it was so hard to watch the people who were like you, who thought they were about to be on Broadway with the show, who, you know, who had gone through it for years and years and developed it. And I still am so sad that they had to go through that. It's just, it sucked. But I feel, you know, it's so cliche to say everything happens for a reason, but it absolutely does. It's given me a perspective of being in Hamilton. So I'm playing the king now. It's 10 minutes. Everyone would be like, of course you love it. Yes, of course. But I've done it 650 some times, right?
Wow.
And I'm about to finish. I'm in my last 2 weeks of the show.
Congrats.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
But you better believe I am making clear to everyone that I will be playing the king again until I have to be rolled out in a wheelchair. I love doing this.
Yeah.
I'm so grateful for it.
Yeah.
I'm so glad it exists and that it will be around for a long time.
Yeah.
I will,
oh my God,
gratefully go back and praise for what this job is. And I know that people outside of the business are like, well, of course you would. But I think that you and I know that it takes something like a nerd situation for you to realize when you're in a moment, no matter how great it is, how to enjoy it, how to have gratitude for it. And
oh my God,
it's almost like another part of the job, figuring out how to have gratitude for each moment.
Well, you have to go through those heartaches to be able to appreciate the light.
Yeah.
And I really needed to go through my heartaches and my drought and my years of struggling because, you know, most people do that right out of college and they sort of figure it out, which is better financially too, to figure it out early on than to be like, you know, a full grown adult and like not know how to save your money. I mean, these are really important things. And
right.
Yes, yeah, so I wholeheartedly agree. You know, I'm in my Broadway show now and I'm so grateful. I feel so lucky every day that I get to do this. And I desperately don't want the show to close. You know, I want it to run forever. Right. Whereas when I was in my other shows on Broadway, I was like, I don't care if this closes. I mean, then I'll be available to do other stuff.
Right.
You know, like I didn't have that perspective.
Right. Well, we're lucky. Lucky that we get to be old timers in the business now. I mean, it's just funny to me because, you know, I have a show. I have to explain who Tonya Harding is to this ensemble. I mean, it's amazing.
They're
all so great. And they have a wonderful perspective and a lot of gratitude. But, you know, they're going to have the same issues that you had. What happens when you graduate from college and go directly into Hamilton? It's you know, everyone has a different path and there's different turns on each one. So
my boyfriend, Isaac Powell, starring in Once on This Island, just graduated this spring.
Oh, wow.
He has quite a different perspective than I do, obviously, right now. And it's very interesting to watch it all happen to him right now.
Yeah.
And sort of remember all those feelings and all those discoveries.
He's going on that same path.
The same one. I mean, it's slightly different. I was like the silly character,
right,
you know, supporting role. He's like the sex symbol ingenue, leading man, you know?
Right.
But he also, you know, he's also very grateful. He's much more like emotionally mature and I think further along than I was at his age. But it's just crazy to sort of, it takes everything from me. I have to stifle every time I want to say when I was your age or like,
yeah,
you know, you have to sort of just let him figure it all out himself and on his own.
Yeah. Back in my day.
Back in my day.
Yeah. Now, I think that's actually, you know, having a relationship with somebody in the business is great. And it also has its own challenges.
Oh, no, it's really, really easy all the time.
Well, I would say, especially for gay men, it's like, at least when you're straight and you're dating an actor, you're not going for the same roles at all.
Yeah.
Like, you have different careers, different worlds, casting-wise. But it's tricky when you
I think, you know, it's already very tough if you have two actors, no matter what the sex, because one of them is employed, one of them is not employed, one of them is making more money, one of them is more successful or what have you. But two men, that's a whole other layer of, direct rivalry sometimes. And when I was younger, right out of school, I dated an actor who's pretty well known, and the two of us were literally in direct competition, like for a lot of roles. And I think that we're very different, but you know, coming out of college, they don't really know all of your quirks and stuff. So they see two people the same size, same age, same basic coloring, both can sing and hit this, whatever. And so we were up against each other for so many things. And, you know, when you're living together in a studio apartment, going over sides for the same project on opposite sides of the apartment, like it was just toxic, you know, poisonous.
Wow.
But, and that was tough.
At a young age,
A young age, when you're like still trying to figure yourself out and how to communicate with a partner and like how to, you know, so I definitely experienced the ugly of that. And I sort of swore off actors after that experience. And I've dated people outside of the business and people who are in the business, but not necessarily actors. And now I'm giving it another go.
Give it another go.
I should stop talking before I get myself in trouble. But I have a lot more wisdom in my years now. You know, I can manage and also, like, let's call a spade a spade. Isaac and I aren't going to go in for any of the same parts. He's 23. I'm 31. We look very different. We're different types. So I don't think we're going to be quite like competing. I think little twinges of jealousy are really healthy, actually. I mean, that might just be me personally, but I don't know. It's kind of it challenges you.
Sure. Sure. I mean, it's going to be there. Jealousy is a part of this too.
Yeah.
Jealousy is the thing that you have to manage. It's not that no one's perfect. Everyone's going to have jealousy. So if it's something that motivates you instead of something that cripples you, that's great. You just have to know that that's what you do with that jealousy is utilize it. And I think that you're very impressive to me. You've always been that guy to call Joe's Pub and say, "You're doing this." You're the guy who writes his own shit and asks everyone to be a part of it, and everyone has a great time and says yes to you,
even when I'm like walking on your face.
Oh yes, that's right. What? Wait, what did I do in that? I was walked like a dog.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
You stepped on my face.
And for those listening at home. the second season of It Could Be Worse, there's a plot line where my character, Jacob, is strapped for cash and is sort of getting creative with his ways of being unemployed and making some extra cash. So he goes down the seedy Craigslist path and starts meeting up with some social misfits who need sort of fetishy ways of pleasure. And Rory played one of those Craigslist encounters, and I sort of walked on your foot, trampled you, walked you around like a dog.
Yeah.
Sat on you. I don't remember what I did, but good it times,
was,
right?
It was one of my favorite performances, and I loved it because I didn't have any lines. I just smiled really creepily.
So yeah, if you want to see me like fully spank Rory O'Malley over my lap, you should go to itcouldbeworse.tv.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. With a beard.
Oh, right.
Little Miss Sunshine.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Oh.
I'm not just impressed, but inspired.
Thanks.
By who you are as an artist. I think that you have done so many cool things, and I'm just, you're fearless. And we have fear, we all do, but you walk right through it. You create a lot, and I really appreciate you being on this podcast and talking to me about the nerd situation.
Oh my God, I'm glad we did.
I am too, because it's not the last time that things like that are going to happen to either of us. They happen all the time to everyone in this business, and it's so rare that you actually get to talk about it, you know? And like share with other people that it happened. So I really appreciate it. And thanks for being on Living the Dream.
Oh, thanks for having me, my friend.
Audition, side job, swimming upstream. Believe it or not, you're living the dream.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.